You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Eric Larson is a novelist, a critic, and a retired teacher. He's written three essays that describe what he sees as an increasingly desperate situation in America. His book, A Nation Gone Blind, is a social commentary that argues that a kind of blindness has set in, producing writers who are no longer able to write, professors who are more harmful than helpful, and a nation in which thinking has been replaced by feeling. The book is published by Shoemaker Hort, and it brings Mr. Larson back to my show. Hello.
How are you? It's nice to see you again.
And the last time you were here was as a novelist.
Yes, it was.
Have you written a lot of critical essays over the years?
Yes, I have. I've written for Harper's, New Republic, Commonweal, The Nation, but more sporadically than I've done reviewing, lots and lots of reviewing.
You've described this book as an intellectual autobiography. What does that mean?
Well, it means that the question comes to me that I assume people will ask, is this book literary or is it political?
And where would you like it to be placed in the bookstore, in fact?
Well, that's very, very difficult. I'd like it to be placed up front. But up at the Labyrinth Bookshop at 112th Street, they put it in political, not political science, but political philosophy. Mm. And that distinction was thought to be rather important. But I think it's really it's a book about what I have seen over 40 years. And, pardon, what I've seen mainly from the classroom but also from a life of reading has been most dispiriting. And thirdly, the political changes that I have seen have driven me finally to the writing of the book.
Well, you say 40 years, but you cite 1947 as the beginning of the cultural decline. Don't most historians say that the post-war era was something of a golden age for American culture?
Well, Gore Vidal says in his book, and has said it elsewhere as well, that the golden age was only 5 years long. It was from 1945 to 1950. I've chosen 1947. I mean, the 40 years are my active literary years. But the book does premise for 1947 as a kind of starting point. But there are two or three
reasons.
You
were 6 years old at the
time. I was 6 years old, yeah. The book starts out by saying, or it doesn't start, but early in the book, I give great thanks for having been born in 1941 because I was able to have a bit of a glimpse. I breathed the air and saw the images of the old America, the pre-corporate, pre-TV America. And throughout my adolescence, the changes were just everywhere. And then when I got educated and became a professor, they just simply continued.
And have you been seeing this decline for a long time, or something you've been thinking about for a long time, or is this the sort of thing you come to after you've retired from a day job?
No, not at all. For a long time, that's the answer. I actually was thinking, coming down on the train, of how far back it goes. I was, as a high school kid, just driven crazy by advertising. I despised it. And do you remember those books of the 50s, The Insolent Chariots, for example? And
Vance Packer, The Hidden Persuaders.
Yes, exactly. And they persuaded me that we were in for a rough ride with television and other forms of advertising. I remember being at the what they called the county fair in the neighboring town I grew up in Minnesota. And it must have been 57 or so, because I know I wasn't out of high school, and there were some cars parked in the parking lot, and they were the big old, what we called the Feeny Beauties. And I started looking at how flimsy and crummy they were. My poor friend was terrified that I was about to knock off one of the tail fins of this car. But they were, of course, the great Insolent Chariots.
Do you think that your view would have been different if you'd grown up in New York or Los Angeles?
I don't know, but I do know that having grown up out in Minnesota and then...
Hubert Humphrey territory.
Yes, absolutely right.
And he represents the best and the worst in some ways, doesn't he?
He certainly does for me. Jim Sleeper was saying once when I heard him talk that he's an old Humphrey liberal. And I wrote him recently saying I remembered him saying that, and he says, and I still am. So, yeah, no, I'm happy for that part of my political beginnings, but having my cake and eating it has been wonderful. When I've been teaching, you know, I taught for 35 years in CUNY, and pardon me, the students often, I really had to struggle hard to find a student who knew stuff about the farm. So I have it both ways. I'm very pleased.
But you also were a professor of literature until recently at John Jay College of Criminal Justice.
Right.
that is not your typical school. I mean, you don't have too many English majors at John Jay. In fact, it's also maybe it's not the fairest school to judge American academia from, because it is a specialized school and not one of America's elite institutions.
Well, they think it's one of America's elite institutions.
Well, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, et cetera, Berkeley.
We could talk about that maybe in a minute if we can, but John Jay was in another way almost the perfect place for me to make these observations, because the students weren't self-consciously literary. They were just kids, and a fair amount of them were adults as well. And so I got a kind of a pure reaction from them about books, ideas, and literary matters. So I don't know if I'd... I mean, the book comes down so strongly against academic humanities that I wouldn't want to... Near the end of the second chapter, which is called The Death of Literary Thinking in America, I say that if I were 16 again, I don't think I'd go to college. I'd skip it. I'd stay away.
My guest is Eric Larson, whose latest book is A Nation Gone Blind, America in an Age of Simplification and Deceit. But, you know, if you had grown up 15 years earlier, you might not have gone to college anyway, because much of the time you're talking about the decline of America as America's educational institutions was changed by the fact that people stopped quitting school in the eighth grade.
That's all true.
And the colleges started booming, and then it seems to me that when you have a larger student body, then you're also going to have more good students, but a lot more bad students as well.
Well, you know, it's interesting because there have been two phases of that. One, I was just near, and that was the GI Bill phase. And that is when American colleges were at their absolute very best, when they met that huge influx of guys after the war. And it's when, at least in the humanities, all of the guys I was educated by out at Carleton College were of that vintage, and they were solid as rocks, real literary people. And now there's no literary people left.
Well, you describe young professors as having a totalitarian impulse, speaking openly about reshaping the minds of students to make them more ideologically acceptable. What ideology do you think they're indoctrinating them into?
It's very, very complex. First, the ideology is that of simplification. The new faculty are, I call them, the adult children of the age of simplification, and that age is the 60-year period of the mass media's influence on the typical American mind. What that influence has done, I'm not sure here where to go, because I want to talk about the first chapter as well. But what it's done is...
We'll get to all three. It's okay.
Okay. Well, all
right. But you were talking about teaching, so we're following that line of thinking.
Those who have become the simplified don't look for themselves. They have abandoned the essential practice of being empiricists. There's a wonderful... I think it's a wonderful... I used to enjoy it in class so much, a part about Voltaire's Candide. And we talk about, you know, empiricism. And one of the things that's fun is, how do you know a dog is a dog? And people say it's obvious. But it wasn't obvious to those who first had to identify how you determine a dog is a dog.
So you're saying that all of the habits of mind of the Enlightenment, skepticism, empirical observation, the ability to accept multiplicity and paradox, they're no longer valued?
They're not valued, no. They're highly unvalued. I had a colleague, a younger colleague, insulted me once by saying, "Oh, I suppose you're going to go around looking for ironies." And so the interest is in doing good. I emphasize this in the book all the way throughout. I think they're in error, but their motives have been to do good.
But aren't they your political allies?
Oh, no. Oh, not at all.
Well,
not anymore.
Isn't the sense, at least from what I've been reading, that the great majority of American teachers, at least in colleges, are liberals?
That word won't work. They're not old Humphrey liberals, as a Humphrey liberal was in 1935. They're Hillary Clinton liberals, or if they're not that, they're the ineffective.
Whatever happened to the Marxist teachers who people like David Horowitz were decrying for so long?
Yeah, Arnold Kettle. I think they've withered away. Some of them are still there. And in the book, I remark on one who still exists. And my point about him and the others is that they're not literature profs, but they're political profs. And they're advocating goodness, like anti-gay bashing and anti-feminism and so on. But they're not teaching the literature. The literature is becoming a little handmaiden, a set of footnotes that will exemplify the good and the bad.
You're sounding almost like Alan Bloom right now.
Alan or Harold?
Alan, not Harold.
Uh-huh. Am I? I'm not. I don't know to what.
Well, he was talking about abandonment of the canon.
The American Mind Bloom. Oh, yes, sure. I haven't read that book for many, many years, but I did finally read the quite wonderful Bellow book, fictionalizing him, Bloom. But, you know, I do sound like him, and I suppose I share a fair amount with him. But I grew up in a literary family and in a literary place. I grew up as a faculty brat, and I saw profs, and I saw them drinking and eating and talking, and I think that's perhaps where I got a good share of my literary education, but they were literary. They loved the books. Of one of them, they were speaking, one who happened to be independently wealthy, and I was the fly on the wall one summer afternoon while they were having a lunch, and they determined that this fellow, all he really wanted was to write a good sonnet. He didn't have to work for a living, but he would come and teach for a dollar a year. It was said. I don't know if it's true. But so I wanted to write. And I began writing, and I was in high school, and I continued, and I had some success, and then I had some more success. I wanted to bring a new brilliance to the literary life, and then as things began to happen, particularly around the middle 70s, the literary life started going dead. And
Wait. So you say here that the moral complexities of the human experience in Henry James, Edith Wharton, Faulkner, Philip Roth, etc., have been replaced by a literature with messages, a moralistic sloganeering. And then I started thinking about some of the writers who've come along since World War II.
Yeah.
Don DeLillo, Thomas Pynchon, Laurie Moore, Jonathan Franzen, Anne Beatty, T.C. Boyle, and I can go on and on and on.
Yeah.
And these are just Americans. There are many in Europe. They don't sound to me like sloganeers.
I don't think that's a quote from me, the sloganeer. Is it? Is it a quote from the publisher?
I guess.
Yeah. But in any case, I mean, that's not a contrary to my thinking. Let me tell a story here that may help clarify this a little bit. The authors that you've just read are not highly admired by me. Sometimes, like Laurie Moore, I've been quite highly amused by. I'm not a DeLilloist. I'm not a Pynchonite. My own literary desires and impulses really they had to wait during that period.
But this is a matter of taste, isn't it? These are still writers. I mean, I personally did not respond all that well to James Joyce. Does that make James Joyce anything less as a writer? Well, he's not my favorite, but I understand that he may be the greatest writer of the 20th century, as some people claim.
Yeah. No, I mean, there we are. Of course there's a matter of taste involved. Absolutely, no question whatsoever. And Joyce is, of course, one of the things that I was weaned on and still emulate. That requires some qualification. The writers that you've mentioned many times are very close to agenda writers. DeLillo has this view that he wants to convey, and I don't think that conveying views is the function of art. I think that conveying the nature of existence is the function of art.
And William Faulkner had views that he expressed as well.
His views are almost non-existent in the books. His thoughts, he said, maybe in 1,000 years, but that wasn't even about integration, but that wasn't even in a book, I don't believe.
And Auden, one of the greatest poets of his time, boy, he sure told us about his views.
How so?
Well, I think in the, he wrote books, he wrote poems that had very much expressed his political views.
So. Oh, sure, but the poems first, the views are second. You know, he repudiated the 52nd Street poem, which I, of course, adore and love, with the lights going out all over Europe. Let me read something.
Wait, we're going to take a break.
Oh, okay.
And then you can come back and read it. Yeah. My guest is Eric Larson, spelt with a C, not the Eric Larson with a K. His book, A Nation Gone Blind, America in an Age of Simplification and Deceit, is published by Shoemaker Horde. Stay with us for more. We're back with Eric Larson, who has written a book called A Nation Gone Blind, America in an Age of Simplification and Deceit. It's published in paperback by Shoemaker Horde, which is an imprint of the Avalon Publishing Company. Before we go on, I have to tell you that you have stirred up my staff, and so they have started sending me things that they feel argue the other case. September 1st, 1939 by Auden, Orwell's Homage to Catalonia, Christopher Isherwood's Berlin Stories, a lot of Hemingway, Steinbeck, Grapes of Wrath. They all had agendas.
Sure they did, and they're not all equally great works either, nor are they all artworks, that is, art literature. The Isherwood is delightful. The Steinbeck is laborious. But that isn't the point. The point really is that this agenda is of a different kind. This agenda is a simplified agenda. It boils down to the old closed rooms of the mind, as I call them, race, class, gender, and ethnicity.
Wait. 1947, race, class, and ethnicity were treated quite differently than they are today. That may be a golden age, but it was also a bad time. People were open in their racism. Father Coughlin had just stopped being on the radio, if you want to talk about anti-Semitism. Class was, we went through a slight period where we went less class conscious up through the Vietnam War. But, as a result of all of that, in those years that you decry, in the last 60 years, we've had the civil rights movement, the women's movement, gay rights movement, greater concern for the rights of the disabled and handicapped. And I can say that those are all positive steps. And if there's been some trade-off, well, maybe those trade-offs were good.
Well, they're good things, but if they've brought about the death of the individual self and the death of American literary excellence, then that's a bad trade. I wouldn't, obviously. Somebody says, I know it was in this interview, somebody says, said to me, yes, perhaps so, but you're not saying, I assume, that racism doesn't exist or that class, gender, and ethnicity don't exist. And I answered, obviously not. Mm-hmm. But then I go on and say, what I am saying is that whole realms of the population, including writers chosen by the State Department, more on that in a moment, to represent the nation around the world, have been conditioned and simplified to the point where they not only rely on buzzwords, but actually think that the buzzwords are correspondent with reality. So, I should say that before I read the piece from
there. All the writers, my brother was sent to Pakistan when he wrote a book called The Rug Merchants, a novel called The Rug Merchants. I don't think anybody told him what to say.
No, I'm not saying that at all. But I am saying that let me go back and tell you how this really started. In 2002, it happened to be Pearl Harbor Day, the Times had an article about 15 American writers who had been asked by the State Department to write on the subject of what it means to be an American writer, or a writer in America. Mm-hmm. Well, that piqued my interest very greatly.
Who did they choose? White House is going to have a different agenda, isn't
it? It's not a State Department, really, but a writer's a writer, and if a writer accepts an assignment on a subject, then the writer had better do their very best at it. So I immediately got hold of the thing. You had to download it from the Internet because by some arcane law it's unpublishable in the U.S., but only in foreign distribution. Now, I don't want to name the names. They're right here on page 30 in the book. I'd rather have people buy the book and find the names, but I will read the grades. Mm-hmm. I graded them. I read them. I was shocked. They were appallingly bad. I reread them, made notes, and graded them. I'll read the grades. F, D, F, D plus, D, D, A plus, A, B plus, D minus, D plus, B, D minus, F, B minus. I will say that the B minus is Robert Pinsky. Well, that's as far as I'll go. I will say also that I graded one too high. And that was Richard Ford. He should have had an F. But now these pieces, they're granted, they are essays. But they are the most amazing essays. To read them is to be appalled.
Now that surprised me because although I'm not going to spill the beans, some of these people are better than others as writers. Well, but some of them are really terrific writers, and you've given a number of them D's, and maybe they just wrote bad essays, or maybe it's just your opinion again.
Well, no. I have.
You mentioned Richard Ford.
Oh yes, I did. Yeah,
he's a pretty good writer. I'm sorry.
There is some question there. If we want to talk about that, we can. But I'd rather talk about my book. I'd love to come back and talk about his books, but I'd have to reread them, and I don't want to do that. I think it would be a real waste of time, frankly. My point is that these people, whatever they do, and I've read a great deal of their non-essay writing, have proven themselves a national and international embarrassment in this volume. And the reason is because they cannot think for themselves. They cannot. And I prove it. I take three of the essays and give them a real close reading. Some of them are shocking in that they cannot answer the question. They go in circles.
Maybe they just would bang something out.
Well, if they bang something out, they're traitors to the art. They're traitors to literature. They're traitors to the U.S. They're traitors to you and me. Our tax money paid for them, something like $1,500 a pop. And this was a year after 9/11, at a time when they were going to be presented as not only custodians of Americanism, but as ambassadors of the American literary arts. No. They are not to be excused on any grounds that maybe they banged something out.
My guest is Eric Larson, novelist, critic, former teacher at John Jay, a teacher of a professor of literature at a college of criminal justice. His latest book is A Nation Gone Blind, America in an Age of Simplification and Deceit. It is published by Shoemaker Horde. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Haven't social critics been making the same argument as you do since the 1970s, that America has dumbed down and that and we haven't gotten to television, but that television dulls the mind and that consumerism distracts people by producing more and more cool-looking things to buy?
Oh, sure, and I've been in on that. I've been doing my own complaining, too, for all those years. I spent, in 1991, I think it's when I began this book, but I didn't know it then. I had gone to a meeting at the college where I was disabused of the idea that I had been able to escape the so-called culture wars. And at the meeting, it was made very clear that they had permeated my department. And one of the phrases that was used, we were talking about what books should be chosen for great books courses in a survey unit. And, my colleagues wanted there to be more books by women and gays and others ethnicities, and this is a course that is a Homer to Virginia Woolf course. So I, of course, said I thought they should be chosen because of their literary significance, their historical effect and influence. And I was repudiated quite soundly and was told that that's a foolish position to take because all things are political and every decision is political. And that was the beginning of the non-literary. It was when simplification had eliminated literature.
So when you saw that Times list of the 50 greatest novels post-World War II, you must have gone bonkers, judging from what you're saying.
Sorry. Some of them are not good books, and some are terrible books. And it seems to me that I would probably... Well, I've been saying this for many, many years. I don't think the winner was a wise choice at all. It's a very poor book. It's an imitative book, and I'm a Stanley Crouch on that one. Do you know his essay on the book? It's quite something to read. He despises it, and I think it's a bandwagon book essentially. And that's another thing, of course. What's happened in the age of simplification is that bandwagonism has replaced thought, and so of course ramps for people in wheelchairs are a good thing, but I would like it if people could think about life, too. Do the ramps and gay rights have to replace all other aspects of life? I might read, of course, there's not time for that, but I have a wonderful, to me, a wonderful passage, where at least it's a passionate one, that asks simply, in this literary situation where race, class, gender, and ethnicity are the subjects that control all others, rather than letting life be the horse that draws the work into being,
so like
where's all the rest of life?
So like John Stossel, you say that women's studies, gay studies, black studies are really just victim studies.
Oh, absolutely. The third chapter of the book argues that all of the victimology studies are essentially dishonest. And it comes out very strongly.
And aren't they really, according to their defenders, an attempt to redress inequities of the past if a lot of writers have been, and a lot of history has been excluded from the curriculum because history and literature have been seen as basically dead white male, then, and with a few exceptions, Virginia Woolf and Edith Wharton, I guess.
Yes. No. My argument is obviously not in favor of slavery or suffering or of gay bashing or women hating or misogyny or any such thing. My argument is that if history has been excluded from the study of history, then let's include it and have it be history that is fair, open, broad, true, real, and that does draw itself from life. But if you take, for example, victimology studies, that's not what they are at all. They insisted. This has happened when I began teaching in the middle 70s. I started in 71, and very, very soon I was embroiled in these questions about whether there would be a black studies department. And, for example, Puerto Rican studies and ethnic studies and so forth. But they didn't want just to have things studied. They wanted to be the study and to be the discipline and the subject of it. So it's no longer history, but it's politics. That is to say, it is a politicized curriculum. And the problem with it is, for example, I do a long analysis of Oedipus, the king, Oedipus Rex, to show that two huge things. One, meaning that pain, suffering, does not in and of itself have meaning. Terrible, sad, horrible fact of life. And secondly, that meaning, that passion, pain cannot be shared. Everybody is locked into their one single physical body, and only there can pain or pleasure be experienced. Now, if you take, for example, victimology studies, they're premised on the significance of pain. And they also, I think, are very unfair because they claim that they share the pain that was suffered by those in earlier ages, and that ain't true.
People listening might be a bit confused as to your political thinking, because on the one hand, you are saying certain things that a number of conservative critics have said over the years. On the other hand, you are very critical of George W. Bush. So do you see him as a reflection of what's gone wrong, estimation?
First, I'm an old Humphrey liberal, and I will be till I die. There's a passage in
you
the book.
You and Jim Sleeper and about three other people.
Oh, fine. Maybe we can have something happen someday. the whole Democratic Party has been destroyed. The liberalism in America has committed suicide. It began doing it at the same time that academia began its victimological studies conversion. As a result, we will see nothing happen for the good until Thomas Friedman has argued twice in the paper for a third party in 08. And then it's very unusual to find somebody like him arguing such a thing. No, this is the real gist of the book. The real gist is that again and again and again, it says that we are no longer a free republic. It always says it. Every time this comes up, I say, you know, if we are not already, if we haven't already lost our free republic. In other words, if the nation is no longer a free nation, then it's a nation under tyranny, because that's the only thing that can replace freedom. But the age of simplification makes people think that the surface is the only thing there is, and so they look around and they see everything looking normal. Everything looks the same. So they figure, hey, this can't be a junta. We can't possibly be in a state of tyranny or loss of freedoms, but we, I'm afraid, are. And that's the book's great cry. Let us look for ourselves. The teachers aren't looking. They're just seeing buzzwords. One of the writers I give a D to, he actually is a very widely known writer and a critic. And he actually treats the buzzwords, he says something like, to use the necessary buzzwords. Well, what writer who has been trained as a writer and a thinker, and who still has their own individual meaningful self that will allow them to see things as and for what they are, could possibly say that he's got to use the buzzwords because the buzzwords are there.
I'm interested in your citing Thomas Friedman's call for a third party, considering the fact that the last time a third party candidate ran in a major political campaign, people were so outraged, as Ralph Nader were so outraged that people actually wrote letters to the New York Times saying we should eliminate third parties America. Mm-hmm. Is this a matter of picking and choosing?
I have to say one thing. The situation is so deteriorated. The age of simplification is so extreme, so thorough, so all embracing that the simple fact is there was only one meaningful candidate in that last election, and it was Ralph Nader.
In the 2000 election?
Yeah, in 2004. Oh, no, he didn't run, did he?
Well, he did, but nobody paid any attention.
But both people do blame him
whether they should or not.
If a person wants to have a shock by going and just realizing that in 2004, not one matter of significance or importance was discussed in the entire campaign. And that can't happen except in an age of simplification. How can people think that that is a political life? Very dismal, very pessimistic book.
And on that dark note, we end this conversation.
Okay.
I'm tempted to say I got to cut and run, but I don't want to be accused of politicizing this conversation any more than necessary. Eric Larson's book, A Nation Gone Blind, America in an Age of Simplification and Deceit, is published by Shoemaker Ward, H-O-A-R-D. My great thanks to you for being on our show again.
Thanks so much. I hope to see you again.